Well, we can actually incorporate into this quite well. In the earlier tradition of the Vedic tradition, there was an understanding of the afterlife, if you like, which was basically like a heaven, like a svarga. And after death, you go to heaven in some sense. Now, that was a bit more complicated in the sense that you went to the Pretaloka, the world of the ghosts, the kind of intermediate stage, before you went into the Pitriloka, the world of the ancestors, which is really heaven, svarga. And that model seemed to be in conflict or contrasted with a model of reincarnation, where the self in the Upanishads, you get this idea of the Atman being reincarnated over and over again, like a caterpillar climbs to the end of a blade of grass and it falls over onto the next one. So the soul goes from body to body. And they try to reconcile these two models through the idea of that the soul goes up to the realm of the heavens and then comes back down as rain. But some have argued that there is a sort of a tension, if you like, in the Hindu tradition between these two ideas, the idea of heaven and the idea of liberation. Because as in Buddhism, liberation comes to be the idea that you're freed from heaven, because you go to heaven, but then you're only there for a short time, then you come back again. Well, you might be there for a few million years or something, but you come back into the world when your karma is used up. And so, particularly Buddhism and Jainism, who wants heaven? We want liberation, not heaven. And that idea comes into Hinduism as well. So you get an idea, a worldview focused on liberation from the cycle of rebirth, which includes liberation from heaven, versus an older view that when you die, you go to heaven. So that's the contrast.
Could you talk a little bit about this reincarnation? Is it the same body, the same person? Is it the same person, different body? Or is it one life is finished, and then a totally new life comes? Or is it the same person, the same mind, the same body?
Yeah, the Buddhist view is that that life is finished and a new life begins. It's just a process.
So no connection between
them. In Buddhism there isn't, but in Hinduism, in the Upanishads there is. It's the same self, the Atman.
The same self.
Which carries on through. And there's various words for that. Atman is the famous one. It's like, which originally meant breath, but comes to mean self, like pneuma. And in German it's Atem, isn't it? Breath, Atem. Atem,
mehr Breath.
Gibt das Leben, breath gives life.
The same word?
Same word, yeah. It's good, yeah. So Atman is related to that. Both of them have come from the same root. It's like in Greek you get the word pneuma, which meant breath originally, came to mean soul or spirit. So Atman, likewise, comes to mean spirit or soul. And it's that gets reincarnated over and over again. And the other word it's used is jiva. And jiva means the soul in its bound state, really, that gets reincarnated. So jiva is the Atman in a state of bondage, if you like, that gets reincarnated over and over again. Individual soul. And in the early Upanishads, the Atman is identical with the Absolute, with the Brahman. But it comes to... And in later traditions, jiva comes to be the individual you, the unique you, which doesn't merge with the Absolute, which goes to one of the heavens. Actually, talking about heaven again, in the later traditions, which we won't be looking at particularly to this term, you get liberation again, identified with svarga, with the heaven of Krishna or the heaven of Shiva. So... In the Puranas that we've mentioned, you get the universe conceptualized as an egg. So let's take Shiva. The world of the Shiva Loka is at the top of the world egg, so kind of we're here somewhere. So when you die, when you get liberated, you go to the Shiva Loka. You get reborn in the Shiva Loka, which is really heaven. But it's also identified with liberation. So it's quite complex. So then you've got these two worldviews, moksha versus heaven, liberation versus heaven. In the later tradition, there's a tendency for them to merge back together again. So actually, heaven is the Shivalika. But then you get other traditions come along and say, like, is particularly in Shaivism, like the Kashmir Shaivism comes along and say, oh, well, that's just a lower level of understanding. We have a liberation, we have a moksha outside of that, outside of the world egg. So yeah, you get this tension between the two. So yeah, so the soul egg goes on being reincarnated over and over again. And it's the same essence, and I get reincarnated in a different body. So we've got a physical body, but you've also got this what they call the linga sharira, or the sukshma sharira, which is a subtle body that the soul carries on going in. I mean, that's the blueprint, if you like, for the physical body.
Is it soul or is it mind?
Ah, it's soul, because the mind is within the realm of matter. So you've got the soul, the spirit, and then you've got nature, or matter, Prakriti. And within this realm, this everything that evolves from this realm is included. When you say the I eat my dinner, I go to sleep, I get up in the morning, that's not the soul speaking, that's the ahankara, that's the I, the ego. So it's not the true subject of first-person predicates. The true subject is deeper than that. It's deeper than the language, deeper than the first-person singular I. And it's this soul. Now, the Buddhists come along and say, well, what's the point of that? It's completely theoretically redundant. Just get rid of it. So the Buddhists got rid of the notion of soul. They kept and analysed what was going on in this process of I. So for the Buddhists, you've got a flow of consciousness which is made up of different moments. Chitta, what they call chitta kshana, moments of consciousness. And one causes the next. So the person here, let's call this time Y, is completely different from the person here at time B. According to the Buddhists, and all that links them up is memory and continuity. So when you die there, you'll be born somewhere else because of this causal, like a fire.
So chitta-kshana is what?
Kshana is moment of chitta, of consciousness.
Moments of consciousness.
So it's like
yes.
In the old days, you had a film, which was stills, but it seemed to be moving. So that was their view of the mind. Yes. It's a bit like stills in a flow.
Yeah.
But they also maintained a causation there, the one moment caused the next. Now, the Hindus rejected that. So, well, what links them all up together? Even the Buddhists had that problem. And the Buddhists postulated this notion of bhavana, something, some underlying substrate. And then later Hindus thought, well, that's the same as the soul, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, in the Samkhya system, which we'll be looking at next week, you get this idea that the soul, the Purusha, is quite distinct from matter. So what gets reincarnated is this, really. Although the soul gets reincarnated, but technically it's embodied within Prakriti. So there's the soul, and it's surrounded by the gross body and the subtle body. And when the gross body dies, the subtle body carries on into the next gross body.
Does the soul in Hinduism have a beginning and an end?
Has no beginning.
No beginning.
No.
And no end.
No end, really. Unless the end is liberation. Liberation is a kind of end. Because it's merged in the monistic doctrine, it's merged in with the absolute. But souls are beginningless. Now, by the time we got to the Bhagavad Gita, which is part of the Mahabharata, which is started to be composed during the first millennium BC, um, So, and this this epic grows, as we saw last week, grows in the context of the adherence to Varnashrama Dharma, the ideology of and the ideology of renunciation. Do you remember what Varnashrama Dharma was? That the Dharma with regard to your duty, with regard to your Varna, your class, and your ashrama, your stage of life. So the four Varnas, the priests, the warriors, commoners, and the Shudras, the serfs. And your stage of life as a student, householder, a retired person, I suppose, really, and a hermit. A renouncer. Those are the four stages of life. And you adhere to a good Brahmin will adhere to his dharma. And we have this developing. And then you get the growth of kingdoms in the political world. You get the growth of kingdoms in the, particularly in the 4th century. But so now about 500 AD to the end of the first millennium, you get the growth of sectarian worship of particular gods. And sacrifice gives way to puja, worship.
4th century AD or...
Yeah, AD, and... And to perform puja, which is the main sort of ritual act of Hinduism, really, which is making an offering and receiving a blessing, and that's to express love or devotion, bhakti, to a god. And this became the central religious practice of Hinduism, still is. And it became bhakti, devotion, to a lord, Bhagavan, or Bhagavati, a god or a goddess. So this becomes what we recognise today as Hinduism, really, during this period. And the two particularly important gods, Shiva and Vishnu, and today we'll look at Vishnu and in the Bhagavad Gita. Now Vishnu comes in the later Upanishads, he's there, and he's way back there in the Rig Veda, but as a sort of not a particularly important god. But he comes to dominance from the 8th to the 6th centuries BC, or he's there in the later Upanishad, doesn't come to dominance at that time. And his iconography develops of this god who's got four arms, and he lies on a cosmic snake called Shesha, on an ocean, an infinite ocean. And he's got various consorts, particularly Lakshmi or Shri, Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth and prosperity, and Shri. And he lives in Vaikuntha at the top of the Royal Neck in the Puranic cosmology. So I'm anticipating myself a bit. So you've got the Royal Neck, which is the Puranas, and Vaikuntha is heaven. Vishnu's heaven at the top of the Royal Neck. So the Shaivas have got a different, they've got the Shiva Loka there instead of Vaikuntha. But for the Vaishnava, it's Vaikuntha. And that's where Vishnu dwells in his four-armed form. In the Puranas, that's a Puranic ideal.
Why four arms?
I don't know why he's got four arms. He's got different. He holds different things in his forearms. So he's got a conch shell, which I guess represents the sound of the universe or something. He's got a discus, his weapon, with which he destroys evil. He's got a mace, and he's got a fear not gesture in his other hand. Is he? I can't remember. Do you remember what he's got in his
Shankara, the conch?
Conch, yeah.
Yeah. Chakra, gada. So gada is very
the club.
Yeah,
the mace. Representing authority, I think, or kingship. Yeah, so the conch, the shankar, the conch that you blow. Also, you probably hear it, I'm not sure.
Conch, discus, the.
Conch, mace. Discus, club.
Club, and mace.
And fear not gesture, has he got?
Yeah, I think that there is. Yes.
Abhaya Mudra.
That's right.
Yeah. I should have brought a picture, no, I've got a picture of Vishnu. And he manifests in the world. He's also, although he is the transcendent God, he's also immanent in the universe, in the world. And he's also called the inner controller, the Antariyami, the inner controller in the heart of all beings.
Antari.
Antariyami. Antari is inner. And Yami is controller.
Oh.
The one who controls Yami. Yeah. Antariyami, the inner controller. In the heart of all beings. And he incarnates into the world in various forms. And in the mythology, there are 10 forms. There's Matsya, the fish, Kurma, the turtle, Varaha, the boar, Narasimha, the half lion, half human, Vamana, the dwarf, Parashurama, the Rama with the axe, Rama himself, the hero of the Ramayana, Krishna, the hero of, partly the hero of the Mahabharata and later texts, the Buddha, and the future incarnation Kalki, who will come out to restore Dharma again at the end of the world age, when everything is in decay, when Dharma is in decline. Kalki will come again on a white horse out of the sea to restore order.
And where does that, which text does that come in?
It's in the Vishnu Purana.
It's the Vishnu Purana.
Yeah.
And he's the future?
He's the future incarnation, the Avatara.
Yeah.
Avatar's come into the English language now, isn't it?
Yes.
That's a good film, isn't it? From a root tree to cross over. So Avatarati means a descent form, really. Someone who's come down. So Vishnu who comes down. Vishnu.
How did Buddha actually come to be believed as an avatar?
He is an odd man. The later tradition said Vishnu incarnated as the Buddha to deceive the wicked. so the wicked would follow the Buddha, yeah. And then through following the Buddha, even the wicked would be saved.
So that is Buddha Gautama, or not
yeah,
Buddha?
Yeah,
it is Buddha.
Gautama, yes.
Yeah.
Historical Buddha. So the Buddhists are really Hindus, but they're bad Hindus.
all the texts, the Puranic texts, are obviously, you know, before that, is it not? So where is it mentioned as an avatar, in what text?
I think the Vishnu Purana.
Vishnu Purana.
But the Buddha dies about 400 BC. Gombrich says 411. Very precise. So these texts are generally formed in the first millennium. So they knew about it, but the Buddhists were a strong force around, and they had dialogue with the Hindu philosophers and Buddhist philosophers were in dialogue with each other. Now, the Vishnu has a complex early history. Originally, there's a number of independent gods come to be identified with him. Particularly Narayana, a god called Narayana, who occurs in the Shatapatha Brahmana, who's an early Vedic god. Vasudeva becomes a name for Krishna. Vasudeva could have been an independent god who gets identified with Krishna. Hello. So Vasudeva is another name for Krishna. So could you pass that down now? Thank you. So it's a complex history, this, but you get a gradual, over the years, you get a fusion of these deities all together. So Vishnu gets fused with Narayana, and Vishnu and Narayana gets fused with Vasudeva Krishna. And Krishna becomes an incarnation of Vishnu. But Krishna himself comes to dominance and becomes a supreme deity, as we see in the Bhagavad Gita, which only mentions Vishnu about twice, I think. Two occurrences of the word Vishnu. So you get these cults, if you like, of Vasudeva Krishna, who is probably a local deity of the Abiras, the clan called the Abiras, another tradition of Krishna Gopala, the young man in Vrindavan, we don't deal with this term, but we'll look at that next term, get fused together. So this is a process of Sanskritization that I mentioned last time, where local gods get identified with these pan-Hindu bigger gods. And Krishna was probably a local deity in the Vrindavan region, the god of the Iberas, who gets identified and becomes dominant in a process of political patronage and popular appeal. And it gets identified with Vishnu and Narayana. So this complex deity Vishnu is an amalgam of these different, probably originally independent deities. But having said that, it's not that there's any disjunction in the concept of the supreme god. He's fairly consistently portrayed, and all Vaishnava traditions of those who follow Vishnu share the following: that the Lord is the supreme person, the Purushottama. And that's interesting. He's the supreme Purusha, the supreme person. And it's different from the early Upanishadic monism, where all is one, if you like. Here in Vaishnavism, you get a theistic reality as distinct from creation, from the world. And this supreme person has personal qualities. He's got guna, he's saguna. He's associated with particular qualities, rather than the abstract absolute, which is nirguna. And he's the cause of the cosmos. Although the universe in its the material of the universe has no beginning, the Lord sets the thing in motion. So he reveals himself through sacred scriptures, in temple icons, in the avataras, and in saints, in the gurus and acharyas. So the Lord has the Vishnu the functions of creating the universe. He doesn't really create it from scratch, but it's not ex nihilo, it's not from nothing, but it's from pre-existent matter or nature. He acts upon it, he maintains it, and then he destroys it. So he has the sarga sthiti and the pralaya, the destruction, srishti sthiti.
Where is that? Sorry.
Probably not on there, is it? No, not on. I haven't put it on there. Sorry, David. He creates, maintains, and destroys the universe.
Destroys it.
And why does he do this? In the Vaishnava traditions, he does it because of lila, because of play. And lila is action for its own sake. It's not for the sake of something else. So many actions are for the sake of something else, but lila is action for its own sake. Now, the Vaishnava traditions, on the whole, with the exception of one, did reject that notion of lila, lila vada. The universe has a purpose, it's not for the sake of play. So in the Vaishnava tradition, the universe has no purpose other than Vishnu's play. Although some later texts do talk about the purpose of the universe being the liberation of souls. Now, these traditions of Vasudeva Krishna developed, we see that in the Mahabharata, and eventually absorbs the Krishna Gopala cult, which is Krishna as a young man in Vrindavan. And Krishna Gopala could have been a tribal god of the Abiras, he probably was, a pastoral deity with his brother Balarama. And the very key texts here are the Harivamsa. Mr. Nayat, the Harivamsa, which is a kind of an appendix to the Mahabharata, the Vishnu Purana, and above all, the Bhagavata Purana. And we won't be looking at those texts here. And also the later, wonderful later poetry, like the Gita Govinda by Jayadeva, and Chandidas, Vidyapati, songs to Krishna. We're going back in time. The Bhagavatas were the worshippers of Bhagavan. And Bhagavan comes to be identified with Vasudeva Krishna. Another word for Vasudeva Krishna is Bhagavan, the Lord. And the Guptas from the 4th to the 6th centuries AD supported the religion of the Bhagavatas. And this patronage by the Guptas suggests a very broad, very wide appeal of the Bhagavata religion. And the central text of the Bhagavatas was the Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Bhagavad, the song of the Lord. So the Bhagavata religion in this early period was very pervasive. And we know that there was a Greek king, Heliodorus, up in Taxilo in Afghanistan now, who was left over. I mean, when Alexander conquered the region, if you remember, he left four, what do they call them? what do they call these kingdoms? He left these four kingdoms behind, ruled by Greek kings, and Heliodorus was the descendant of one of the kings. And he sent his an ambassador to Patna, to the court of a king in Patna. And there, and Heliodorus describes the religion of Bhagavan, of this lord, this Bhagavan, and he identifies Bhagavan with Hercules in his account. So there's an early foreign, if you like, external evidence for the widespread appeal of the Bhagavata tradition. And there's a famous pillar in which a king describes himself as a Bhagavata, a follower of the Bhagavan, of the Lord. So anyway, the central text of the Bhagavatas was this, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, the Bhagavad Gita, there's a debate about where it... It comes in the plot of the Mahabharata, as we saw last week, is the story of this, the way that the Pandavas get banished, because Yudhishthira loses the kingdom in a game of dice. He gets banished into the forest for 12 years, and the 13th year incognito in society, and then they can reclaim the throne, but the Kauravas won't give up the throne, so there's a war. And the Bhagavad Gita comes at a crucial point in the narrative where they're just about to have a war. And some say that this is an interruption of the narrative, so therefore the text was composed externally and interpolated into the Mahabharata narrative. And some scholars say, no, it's an integral part of the narrative itself. And you can see both views. The Bhagavad Gita, personal view, it seems to be a fairly coherent text. So possibly composed over a fairly short period of time. Possibly as an independent text of the Bhagavatas. But anyway, certainly integral to becomes integral to the narrative of the Mahabharata. And it's this dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna. As you know, Arjuna says to Krishna, who is the charioteer, who Arjuna doesn't know he's God, he doesn't know he's an incarnation, says, why should I fight in this war? I'll be killing my kinsfolk. And the story is the way Krishna persuades him to fight in the war. First of all, because Krishna says, because it's heroic. It's virya, it's the heroic thing to do. That doesn't persuade Arjuna. He's not swayed by that argument. The second reason for fighting is you can't kill this soul. The Atman carries on being reborn over and over again. So although you're killing the Kauravas, you're not killing their souls, you're just killing their bodies, and their souls will carry on. And he's not convinced by that argument either. And thirdly, he says, well, you have to because it's your dharma. it's your duty as a kshatriya, as a warrior, to fight in this war. And that persuades him. It is svadharma, his own duty. Because if you don't perform your duty, that upsets the laws of the universe, and then there's chaos. So he fights because of his svadharma. And the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita are then the teachings about how you can be liberated while still performing your duty. Because another question of Arjuna is, which is better, renunciation or action? And Krishna says, you can have both. You can have action in the world, dharmic action in the world, and renunciation as well. And you have renunciation through giving up the fruits of your action to God, handing over you do the best you can, but be detached from the results of your action. You make the best judgments you can in particular situations, but you hand over the consequences to God. Which is wise in a way, because we don't know the consequences of our actions. Now this theology, the theology of the Bhagavad Gita, was established with royal support and had broad basis and wide appeal. And the main importance of the text is dharma. The text is mainly about dharma. And according to Malina, there's an excellent book she's written on the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita mediates between two opposing, what she calls, referential frameworks of human aspiration. Wonderful phrase. The realm of the socio-economic relationships expressed in dharma, and the realm of renunciation through ascetic practices. So I think she's not the first to have observed that, but she articulates it very clearly. So the Bhagavad Gita is an attempt, a successful attempt largely, to reconcile renunciation with dharma, duty in the world. You can be renounced and you can perform your duty. You can be politically successful and at the same time a renouncer, and so gain liberation. So dharma and renunciation are compatible. But action should be performed with detachment. And it advocates this idea of non-attached action, asakta karma. Now the word karma, it means significant action, but it originally meant ritual action. So you can see originally that karma in the Vedas was ritual action, and so the Upanishads come along and say, actually, you have to give up ritual action to attain liberation, because liberation is action. So you don't act. So in Jainism, this becomes an extreme form of non-action, so that you don't do anything, and you eventually die. You starve yourself to death over a period of time as a renunciate, as an ascetic. So you don't act. Don't do anything. But in Hinduism, it becomes detachment, not only from ritual action, but all significant action, karma, not only ritual action, karma, but all action. But you don't give up action, you give up the results, the fruits of action, so you become detached from action. So you can still act, but you're renounced from it. So you don't literally give up action, you symbolically give it up, and you give it up with an inner disposition of detachment. Asakta karma. Because if you're attached to action, that will keep you bound in the cycle of reincarnation. So if your goal is liberation, you have to become unattached to action and its results. Because action is on the whole driven by desire, karma. But if you're living an enlightened life, your action isn't driven by desire, but it's driven by duty and what is right, dharma. And asceticism itself, tapas, that we had in the Upanishads, comes to be interpreted as sacrifice. And you get karma yoga, the yoga of action. And it doesn't mean the yoga of action, actually. It means the yoga of detached performance of action, the practice of acting with detachment. And if we identify our acts with the cosmic cause of action for the welfare of all beings, Bhutahita, we can be liberated. So you act not out of selfish desire, but out of concern for the welfare of all beings, Bhutahita, which is Dharma. So that is a very strong idea in the Bhagavad Gita, that we have to act with detachment for the welfare of all. And if we do that, we can be liberated while fulfilling our duty in the world. You don't have to give up. You don't have to go meditate in a cave in the Himalayas or anything like that. You can be liberated in the world through doing your usual household obligations. But you act from a cosmic cause for the welfare of all beings, not from selfish desire. It also develops the idea of a single supreme God. This is called Vasudeva Krishna, and he is both the majestic ruler and he is the creator of the cosmos and the detached higher self of all, the Paramatman and the Purushottama. Now, although he's the creator of the cosmos, he doesn't create it, as I said, from nothing, but he acts upon pre-existent matter and he impels it, if you like, to be manifest. And this monotheistic framework of the text, and it contains the following features which I've listed here, and this is based on Maninar's book, pages 6 to 7. First of all, there's a single God who creates, maintains and destroys the cosmos over and over again. But as I say, doesn't create from nothing, but creates from pre-existing matter. Now, he is in the world in different embodiments, and he comes into the world to protect Dharma and to destroy Adharma. Adharma is evil or wickedness. And the creation of the world is explained through Samkhya categories. Now, Samkhya means enumeration or numbers. In fact, there's a journal of mathematics called Samkhya, Indian Journal of Maths. And Samkhya was the oldest systematic kind of philosophy we have in India. And, surprise, surprise, it's not monistic, it's dualistic. There's two eternal realities. There's the Purusha, the self, and Prakriti, matter or nature. And the self, the soul, the Purusha, is entangled, or thinks it's entangled in Prakriti. And the goal of life is to free the spirit from matter. Free the self from its entanglement in matter. And it developed various categories called tattvas with which it explained the universe. So these ontological categories.
Tattvas.
Tattvas, yeah.
Yes, tattva. Yes. Tattva, right. Not tapas, I mean tattvas.
Well, it's the same word. Tat just means that. Or that. So, and tva is ness, so it's that-ness.
Oh, yeah.
Tattva is a reality, an existing reality, a that-ness. And the Samkhya developed 24 tattvas, and all these are in the Bhagavad Gita. So it assumes the Samkhya cosmology, but it reinterprets it. So for Samkhya, you've got the self, the Purusha, and you've got matter. Now in the Gita, you have that, but you've got the Lord as well. You've got this sort of triangle, if you like, self, Lord, and matter. And matter evolves in the tattvas. Which we can look at more closely next time. And liberation then is still freeing the self from entanglement in Prakriti, but moksha comes to be reinterpreted to mean, it's an open text of Bhagavad Gita, and some have read it as union with the Lord, and some have read it as maintaining a distinction and separation. So you could have different readings of the text, because it's an open text, it's a very rich text. And it's open to different readings. But it does advocate the devotion, bhakti, to the highest God. There are some passages where the highest God is also the highest liberated self. Now, some would say, well, that's your true self, that's your inner self, that you are God. ultimately. And some interpreted it dualistically that you're not. No, it means the Purushottama, the Supreme Self, is Vishnu, is separate from you as a different jiva, you're a different self. So you've got these two readings of it in the later tradition. And the text itself is open to both kinds of meaning. But it does nevertheless say that bhakti, devotion to God, is the means of salvation, is the highest path. And the Lord is reached through devotion and also by his grace. Now that very structure of devotion to a Bhagavan, to a Lord, implies a kind of a dualism perhaps. But there are passages in the text which suggest a more realistic understanding. Now, the soul is immortal and is reborn until liberated. And after it's liberated, it's no longer reborn. Now, what happens to it at liberation is an open question. Does it merge in with the Absolute? Or is it with God in some way? Is it in Vaikuntha, in Vishnu's heaven? So these questions are interpreted in different ways by the later tradition. But the Lord, Vishnu Narayana, is transcendent beyond the universe and immanent within it. He pervades the universe. And the story is how Krishna slowly reveals himself to Arjuna in the text, culminating in the theophany of chapter 11, where Krishna reveals his universal form to Arjuna. And I've on this sheet that I've given you...
Just because there is no transcendence and immanence discussion in Hinduism.
Oh, there is, yeah. In Hinduism, there is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So probably.
But a philosophical discussion about that, about the meaning of that. Sorry, I've got a couple of sheets up. But in these texts...
Do you have another one?
Do you have another one?
Do you have the other one for the 18 notes?
Oh, yes. Sure. Sorry, I'll show you that. This is just an example of this theophany. Oh yes, sorry. You get the Vishvatirana, the God is beyond the universe, and Vishvatmaka, he's pervading the universe as well. So you get both of those ideas, and you get a later discussion of that in the philosophers. But in these kind of primary texts, they don't have much philosophical discussion of those sorts of things. But here you've got Krishna has revealed himself to Arjuna in his terrible universal form, the Vishvarupa. And at the top there it says, the son of Pandu, that's Arjuna, saw the entire universe in its multiplicity gathered there as one in the body of the God of Gods. So he sees the whole universe in the body of Vishnu, Krishna.
So Krishna is Vishnu there?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What does it mean, the son of Pandu?
Oh, that's just a name for Arjuna. He's the son of his father's called Pandu. Then Dhananjaya, another name for Arjuna, the one the bowman. Then Dhananjaya, confounded, with his hair bristling, Hrisha, standing on end with goosebumps, bowed his head to the god, and with his hands joined in reverence, said, O God, I see in your body the gods and all kinds of beings come together. Lord Brahma on his lotus seat, all the seers and divine serpents, the Nagas. I see you everywhere, many armed, many stomached, many mouthed, many eyed, infinite in form. I cannot find out your end, your middle, or your beginning. Lord of the universe, form of everything, I see you, so hard to behold, crowned, armed with a club, discus-bearing, a mass of radiant energy, blazing in all directions, unlimited, an all-consuming, fiery solar brilliance. That was the passage that... what was his name? The guy who invented the atom bomb.
Beginning with a... No.
Oh, on this. Oppenheimer. He was a very educated guy. He quoted that passage when he saw the atom bomb tests in the desert. If you know, the light of a thousand suns.
Yes.
I acknowledge you as the imperishable, the highest object of knowledge. You are the repository of all this, the unchanging protector of the perpetual law. You are the primeval person, without beginning, middle, or end, infinite in power, infinite in arms, sun and moon-eyed. I see you, your face a blazing fire, consuming the entire universe with your brilliance. This space between heaven and earth is filled by you alone, as is every direction. Having seen this, your marvellous, terrible form, the three worlds totter. I'm not sure that's the real tremble. Great self. Those throngs of gods enter you. Some in dread praise you with gesture of respect, crying hail. Crowds of great seers and perfected beings praise you with resounding praise. Rudras, these are just different deities, Rudras and Adityas, Vasus and Sajas, the Vishva gods, the twin Ashwins, Maruts, steam drinkers, not quite sure who they are, crowds of celestial musicians, Yakshas, Asuras, and perfected beings all gaze at you, dumbfounded. Great arm, seeing your mighty form with its many mouths and eyes, its many arms, thighs and feet, its many stomachs, its gaping mouths full of tusks or fangs. The world's real, and so do I. Vishnu, seeing you touching the sky, shining rainbow-hued, cavern-mouthed, with luminous, distended eyes, I am shaken to the core. I can find neither rest nor resolution. Seeing your mouth dancing with tusks like the flames of the universal dissolution, I am disorientated and without shelter. Have mercy, Lord of Gods, home of the world. And so on and so on. And, you know, he asks Krishna to come back to his ordinary form. And the Lord says, halfway down at 32, I am time. So some people worship time, so they're worshipping Krishna, they're worshipping time. I am time, run on, destroyer of the universe, risen here to annihilate worlds. Regardless of you, all these warriors stationed in the opposite rank shall cease to exist. I've killed them anyway, they're dead anyway. Therefore, go to it, grasp fame, and having conquered your enemies, enjoy a thriving kingship. They have already been hewn down by me. Arjuna, Sabyasachin. Simply be an instrument. Kill Drona, kill Bhishma, kill Jayarata, kill Karna, and the other warrior heroes as well. They are killed by me. Don't waver, you must fight. In battle you shall overcome your enemies. When he had heard Krishna's speech, Arjuna, his palms joined in reverence, trembling, having saluted again, bowing low, terrified, stuttered in reply. And he goes on. So anyway, that's a flavour, a taste of this theophany, this magnificent vision of Krishna, who's the universal God, who's the Lord of time, who's destroying everything and creating everything. What Rudolf Otto called a numinous vision, a vision of the numinous, which Otto characterizes having mysterium tremendum et fascinans, mystery, awe, and fascination.
Who's that?
Rudolf Otto, in The Idea of the Holy. He said the essence of religion was this numinous experience, which is exemplified here in Arjuna's vision of a transcendence, the out of transcendence of the Lord. Now after that, Zaina, who translated the Gita, says it's the greatest anti-climax in world literature, he calls it, because we had this wonderful climax, and then the rest of the text from 12 to 18 is more philosophy and doctrine and so on. I don't think it's a particularly anti-climax. Chapter 18 is actually the final revelation in which Vishnu says to Arjuna, you are dear to me. You get this idea that God loves humanity. Tvam priyameyam, whatever it is, you are dear to me, you are beloved of me. Now, the Gita also advocates different paths to liberation. There's the path of action, karma yoga, which we've looked at, detachment from the fruits of action. There's jnana yoga, which it mentions, which is knowledge of the absolute or discrimination, viveka, of the elements of the universe. And now that is from tattva, the Samkhya tattvas, which we look at, discriminating the self from what is not the self. And finally, there's the highest, according to the text, bhakti yoga. And even for women of low castes, you can achieve liberation through bhakti yoga. And the feature of the text is advocates is Aishwarya bhakti, majestic bhakti, seeing God as king, as the lord of the universe. And this is contrasted with a later tradition, particularly the Gopala tradition, which says actually a higher understanding is to see God as your lover, or as your friend, or as your intimate acquaintance. But here, the Gita, the highest vision is that we just looked at is the Vishvarupa, the universal form, the God as the lord of the universe. And lastly, there's the famous Charamash Shloka, which is abandoning all laws, seek shelter in me alone. Not along, alone. I will save you from all sins, do not fear. And that verse spawned different interpretations and different schools. And one said that you have to have effort, called the monkey school, and you're saved through some of effort of your own. As a baby monkey clings to its mother as she goes through the trees, so the soul clings to Vishnu as he saves them. And the other school, the cat school, was that actually you have nothing you can do can gain your liberation. It's all the grace of God. So you're saved by the grace of the Lord Vishnu, as a mother cat picks up her kittens and carries them somewhere else. So the Lord picks up souls and takes them into liberation. And so the Bhagavad Gita is a terribly important text, sometimes called the New Testament of Hinduism. So do have a read of it. And I think one of the best books is indeed Malinar's book, which came out about 2 years ago now, the Bhagavad Gita by Angelica Malinar, which is a contextualization and a summary. And as published translations, I always think Will Johnson's translation, which this is from, is very good. It's a minimalist translation, and it sticks very closely to the Sanskrit. Of course, all translations are interpretations. So, next week we'll be moving on to Indian philosophy. We'll be looking at Samkhya and the monistic and theistic traditions that develop from that.